Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Although the Senate last month rejected a proposed constitutional amendment establishing the privacy rights of all Vermonters, legislation dealing with this issue is being considered at the State House. Moortown Representative Maxine Grad is the chairwoman of the House Judiciary Committee. She says it's critical for lawmakers to address this issue.
An increasing amount of personal information is being captured and stored electronically. Such information includes health information collected by hospitals and other healthcare providers, electronic mail and postings on social media kept on the servers of electronic communication providers, and photos of license plates captured and retained by law enforcement. New technologies such as drones with high-resolution cameras are able to observe areas where people have traditionally had heightened expectations of privacy. Current state law does not sufficiently address the privacy concerns that these trends raise.
So what's the outlook for this legislation, and why do backers think that it's needed? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Alan Gilbert, the executive director of the Vermont chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Do you think lawmakers need to pass a privacy bill to protect them from government surveillance, or should law enforcement officials have this authority to thwart potential terrorist attacks or other types of serious crime? Do you think it'd be a good idea for the legislature to create a strong ethics commission? Doesn't look like that's going to happen. 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. Also want to mention that Alan Gilbert, after being the head of ACLU in Vermont for the past 12 years, will be stepping down from that post soon. So while we're going to discuss a number of issues being considered in this year's legislative session, we're also going to look back at some of the key issues that Alan has been involved in during his career. So, Alan, let's start off with this privacy bill. The House and Senate have different versions of the legislation. Now a conference committee seems to be coming to an agreement on what this bill should do. Why is this bill needed? What is this bill trying to address?
This bill, it's now Senate Bill 155, is trying to address the way privacy protections, or the lack thereof, have changed because of digital technology. That's really largely what it's all about. I think without digital technology, we probably would not have had this bill. This bill really has four main pieces. It deals with drones. It deals with automated license plate recognition systems, the readers. It deals with medical records privacy. And it deals generally with electronic communications privacy.
So let's just take those one at a time. Let's look at the electronic privacy. What kind of privacy do Vermonters need? What kind of privacy and protection does this bill offer them?
I think most people don't realize with electronic communications, whenever you send any information, it is being retained by somebody. A service provider needs to have information to route your message, and it needs to have information about when a telephone call was made, what signal tower your message or your phone call was sent to. And all that information is stored as electronic information, and it can be accessed by government, by police, if they want to launch an investigation about something they suspect you of having done. That never existed when we didn't have cell phones, when we didn't have e-medical record systems. We had other systems, of course, but because of how widespread electronic communications has become, how easy it is to transmit that information, and how memory has become so cheap that now it's actually more expensive to get rid of information than it is to retain it, we find that government, as well as private companies, just amass huge amounts of information about us, and we think that access to that information by government, by police, should be protected.
So what's the situation right now? What kind of access does law enforcement have?
It depends on which of those sections of the bill you're talking about. if we talk about automated license plate readers. Right now, the police in the state are collecting over 8 million reads every year and putting those into a database that's kept at what's called, what used to be called the Vermont Fusion Center in Williston. And right now, police can access that information when they can articulate a reason for why they need it for an investigation. But it's all there, and by typing in your license plate number, they can pull up all the hits, all the reads that their cameras have made of where you've gone when you've driven by in your car. An image, a photograph is taken of your license plate. It's given a date and a time stamp and also a GPS location stamp. So the data is pretty definitive as to where your car was seen at a particular time.
How does this bill address that?
This bill puts a few more protections on the reasons police have to give for wanting to access that data. And it's also going to create a warrant requirement if police want to access data that's older than 6 months. That's been a sticking point up to the very end during conference committee discussions that really just wrapped up last night and this morning. But it looks like that both sides have agreed to that. And as long as the chambers and then the governor agree to it, that's going to be the new standard.
So law enforcement says, you know, this is helpful information. It can tip them off to where somebody is who they think might be a suspect in a crime. Do they have an argument?
Sure, they have an argument. It's just that we think this information should have some sort of judicial review before police can have access to it. You know, we hear the argument time and again, these systems are no different than a police officer who can write down very quickly as cars go whizzing past the license plates of all the cars he sees. And I think we'd all agree that's really a little bit far-fetched because these systems, as I said before, are collecting millions of plates and keeping that information on file. So the systems are totally different, and the amount of information that's available about us now is so much vaster than it's ever been that it's a different world we're living in.
We did get this email from Chris in South Burlington who wrote, "I was disappointed in the legislature for failing to advance the proposed right to privacy constitutional amendment." That was in the Senate. "We're living in an unprecedented era of commercial and government digital surveillance," writes Chris. "This applies to anyone who uses a cell phone or goes on the internet, not just people who are willingly giving up their rights by joining Facebook." I mean, in this era, as Chris says, isn't everything known about everybody out there?
Right. And so the argument then is, what's the big deal? Shouldn't everybody have access to it? And we actually think that's not the case, that just because there is more access to information doesn't mean that government should have the right to get any of the information that is out there. We do have expectations of privacy still, reasonable expectations of privacy, and the protections for those privacy interests have to be retained.
This bill also addresses drones. What's the issue there?
Drones are an interesting one because drones can be used by police, by government, or they can be used by private interests. And there are very different issues that come up around which of those two groups you're talking about. The drone bill the drone portion in S-155 talks just about police use of drones. So private use of drones, which might include VPR using a drone for news reporting or a private citizen using a drone, that's not addressed other than to say you have to abide by the FAA regulations. The way that the bill addresses police use is it says if you want to use the drone for surveillance, you have to get a warrant and show what the information is that you're seeking and how you're going to get it and so forth. And that's a big change because there's been no regulation of police use of drones up to now.
I wanted to go back to the license plate readers for just a second. You were talking about how the state police would use them. I think I read somewhere that some commercial businesses are using them. And the example was a very large shopping center who would send someone around and get all the license plate information so they knew where customers were coming from. Is that still allowed?
Actually, the bill does not legislate private use of these systems because it probably would be a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, probably be unconstitutional. But you're right. The way that this system was described in the use that you were referring to is you look at the kinds of cars that are coming in and out of a parking lot, and from that you can judge the wealth and possibly the interests of your clientele. If you have a lot of Mercedes and BMWs in the lot in your shopping center, you probably have a different clientele than if you have a bunch of Subarus and old beat-up Volkswagens. So it's amazing how this information is so easy to get if you have the right systems and all the things it can be used for, and that makes us nervous.
Today on the program, our guest is Alan Gilbert, the executive director of the Vermont chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. We've been talking about privacy legislation at the State House, lots of other bills that are involved with law enforcement over there. Your thoughts? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk about saliva tests. This was a really interesting issue that came up this year. The House had given its approval to a plan to allow roadside saliva tests to determine if a driver is under the influence of marijuana or a number of other drugs. And if these drugs were found in a person's system, then the legal blood alcohol level would drop from its current level of 0.08 to 0.05. House Transportation Chairman Pat Brennan supported this change.
It's not only about marijuana, it's about the opiate problem we have in Vermont, the heroin problem, methamphetamines. It tests for 7 to 8 drugs other than marijuana. So I think it's an issue that that needs to be addressed now.
But Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Sears did not support this new approach.
I think it needs more research. I also think you need to have the amounts correct. I mean, if, for example, if the marijuana, if there's any detectable marijuana in the system, my understanding is it can be a person who smoked or ingested marijuana 2 or 3 days ago, now driving, and to count that and make it a 0.05 blood test is problematic to me.
What are your thoughts about this new method of testing for impaired drivers who use alcohol, marijuana, and perhaps other drugs?
Yeah, it really is an interesting question, and the science around the saliva testing is developing, but there are really two questions, one of which wasn't addressed during the discussion. The first question is, can you test for an array of drugs and get accurate reads on how much of a substance a person has in his or her body? And the state police, who had been testing these things, had results looked at by a testing lab in Pennsylvania. And the testing lab said, yeah, these look pretty accurate based on what also is found from the blood samples of the same people that you sent us. There are some discrepancies when it comes to marijuana because of what you were saying. Apparently, marijuana and the long preservation of the THC, the psychoactive metabolite that causes people to be affected by marijuana, can stay in your body and can actually apparently hide. You can get a test that you're negative one day after you've smoked a joint, say, 6 hours ago, and then the next day it's positive, the next day it's negative, and it can go back and forth like this. Marijuana, apparently THC, is kept in the body in mainly fat cells, and sometimes it is pulled out of the body, the fat cells, if I understand this correctly, based on what you've been eating or what you've been drinking. So the reliability of how accurate the tests are is one thing. But the other big question is, okay, we know this person has some presence of marijuana, 1 nanogram, let's say, of THC in their blood. Does that mean they're impaired? We've all gotten used to living with 0.08 alcohol, blood alcohol content. It means you're drunk and you can be pulled over for that. We don't have any of the same standards for any drugs other than alcohol. So even though you might show the presence of an opioid or the presence of marijuana or the presence of any of, I think it was seven other drug families, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're impaired. And it struck us that it's just crazy to go down a road pretending that we know what impairment is when the people who have invented these devices have said specifically there is no way to know at what level of what drug impairment results.
Do you think that this is going to be a key issue perhaps in next year's session as the marijuana bill comes back? Because there were a lot of people who were concerned about legalizing marijuana and its effect on impaired drivers.
Well, when you think about it, this should have been an issue for many years because I think we've all come to accept, because of the debate about marijuana this year, there are a lot of people in this state who are already using marijuana. So it's not a question of how different is it going to be when we legalize marijuana, because I'm not sure it's going to be all that different. But we haven't kept up with how the proliferation of drugs, regulated drugs, such as prescription drugs given by our doctors, as well as what up to now has been illegal substances, we haven't kept up with how they exactly impair our ability to drive. So I think if for no other reason, as long as we still have so many drugs being used by our society, and again, we're not just talking marijuana, we're talking about all the prescription drugs as well, this is going to be a question that's out there, and I know that police will continue to have a strong interest in it.
Today on the program, our guest, Alan Gilbert, Executive Director of the ACLU in Vermont. We've been talking about privacy, saliva tests. When we come back, we're going to look at an ethics commission and racial profiling in Vermont. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. With me today, Alan Gilbert, the head of the ACLU in Vermont. We're looking at a host of issues from this year's legislative session. Your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Alden in Wolcott. Hey, Alden, welcome to the program. Alden, are you there? Well, we'll try to straighten that out in the next couple of minutes and see if we can get Alden back on the phone. Let's talk about the Ethics Commission. You know, when the session started, people were talking in the Senate about a commission that was going to have five or six employees, investigators, looking at allegations of wrongdoing. Final version, I think, had a halftime director. All these cases would be sent to the Attorney General's office. Vermont's one of the very few states in the country that doesn't have an ethics commission. Does it need a strong ethics commission?
Yeah, we think so. I mean, Vermont's an outlier in a number of areas connected with ethics. What you said is correct, but we're also an outlier in that we don't require financial disclosures by candidates and office holders. I think we're one of, I believe it's only two or maybe four states in the country that doesn't do this. And I think that there's a general impression that there's nothing wrong, so why do we need a solution? And I think we don't know if there's anything wrong. That's one of the reasons you have an ethics commission. I also think that people don't understand in this state what is a conflict of interest, because we live with so many of them all the time. We are a large community of 640,000 people or whatever it is, and we often find ourselves in situations where we do have different interests that can affect each other. When you're in a position, certainly a public position, when you do have a conflict like that, it's impossible to say it doesn't exist. It exists. How well you deal with it, and if there's a mechanism for letting you deal with it, is a whole nother question. And I think Vermont has not done a very good job in helping people identify what a conflict is and what you should be doing when you acknowledge that there is a conflict. I think during the session this year, the thing that really took the steam out of the Ethics Commission idea was when legislative counsel gave an opinion, a legal opinion, that only the legislature can police itself, that you can't have an outside agency policing the actions of legislators. And I think when people started thinking about that, it was like, okay, so what's an ethics commission going to do then when it comes to the legislature? And the answer was nothing. They can hardly do anything. They could do something about administration officials. They could do something about people who weren't in the legislature possibly. But I think when people realize this isn't going to do anything to address what some people think are some legislative conflicts of interest, a lot of enthusiasm for the bill was lost at that point.
Do you think that the Ethics Commission bill should also include something that's sometimes called the revolving door? This would be members of the administration or even lawmakers, for that matter, having to wait for perhaps a year before they come back and lobby. Does Vermont need something like that?
Yeah, we really do. I mean, sorely we need something like that. I think we've seen a number of examples just this last year around the EB-5 stuff involving Jay Peake. There was an administration official who went who went to work for the EB-5 companies up there. And that's not a good thing, to one day be regulating a private company that the next day you're working for. I think we'd all agree that's not the kind of situation we want to see happen in the relationship of government and private entities. So, yeah, that's a problem.
We're going to go back to our callers and talk to John, who is calling from Swanton. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to ask Alan a question. I've certainly heard this argument for quite a number of years that, you know, you got to watch out who gets our data and what they can do with it. But generally, I don't hear good examples of what we would be so afraid of. I mean, certainly it can be very helpful to law enforcement. But I'd like to hear some examples of what we're so afraid of if this data is collected and used. How would it be misused?
So that's a great question. And I think if there are a few examples that do come quickly to people's minds, that's good news because it suggests maybe it's not being abused at this point. But I do remember back in 2005, I think it was, when the Bush administration was collecting data on citizen activities, and it was discovered that beyond the government collecting our phone records data, they also had some databases that were watching people who were involved in specific political activities. And I remember there were two different demonstrations, one in Barrie, I believe, and one in Burlington, for which when there were some FOIA requests made by news agencies for this data, you found out that the government was actually watching who was going to specific demonstrations and keeping that on file. So I think there's always the temptation for governments, when it has data, to keep it around just in case. And that's really what the ALPR thing is all about, too.
The license plate.
That's the license plate thing. You know, there's the sense that if you have data, it might possibly be useful at some point in the future. And then people also make the statement that, yeah, and if government has all this data and it shows we weren't at the scene of the bank robbery, isn't that great that it can be used for exoneration of us? Well, if you follow that logic, before you know it, government is collecting all sorts of information about all of us, partly so we can prove our innocence. And our system of criminal investigation and the judicial system do not start with our having to prove our innocence. It works the other way around. So we're worried about this notion that the more data we can collect and retain is a good thing. We don't think that's necessarily so.
Today in the program, our guest is Alan Gilbert, the head of the ACLU in Vermont. We're talking about privacy, ethics commission, saliva roadside tests for drugs. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Alan, we got this post from Paul in Richmond who writes, "If I haven't done anything wrong and I have nothing to hide, why should I care that police know where I've been in my car? Sometimes it seems like there's an over-preoccupation with privacy."
I think some of this depends on how much you yourself as an individual really do value your privacy. And I think most times we don't think very much about our privacy until it's violated. You think your privacy is not being violated now, but you want to remember that if you carry a cell phone with you, you have a tracking device in your pocket or your purse, and about every 7 minutes, a signal is being sent from your phone to a cell tower and from a cell tower to your phone, just in case you want to make a call. You know, that's the whole point. You have a cell phone so you can make a call from anywhere, but you have to be found. The information that's where you are and where the tower is recorded and kept on file for a period of time so that it's possible for people to find out, police to find out exactly where you were within about 35 feet anytime you have your cell phone with you. That's a little bit freaky to think that we really can be tracked, and it's only the protection of things like warrants and subpoenas that keep government from getting information about our whereabouts. I personally, and I think a lot of other people, don't want government to know where we are all the time.
Alan, we also got this email. As big data evolves with even more powerful computers, we'll see a resulting increase in discrimination to the benefit of only certain data groups. Credit scoring is one example where the result will be that a class of people, due to their history of misfortune, are being forever logged in these massive databases. Do you see this big information being used in a whole host of ways?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question because the whole thing with credit scores goes back just about 50 years to the 1960s when credit cards were first coming into use and the credit bureaus were springing up to be able to judge people's credit worthiness. The big difference now is that we have all of this done digitally, and it has become so easy to transmit and to store the information that, as I was saying before, almost any kind of digital information that's created is going to exist forever somewhere. There's an amazing statistic. In 1980, a gigabyte of memory cost about $500,000 to produce and to buy. In 2013, I think that's the last year I looked at this, that same amount of data, a gigabyte, cost a nickel. So whenever you can all of a sudden store so much more data for so much less money, you're going to hold on to it. And that's exactly what's been happening.
Let's go back to our callers and talk with Donald in Georgia. Hey, Donald, welcome to the program.
Hi. Mr. Gilbert, I was wondering what you felt about African Americans in the state of Vermont and about their treatment specifically in respect to the state of Vermont, because I know there were some issues with distribution of pamphlets, KKK for a KKK rally, and I know there were some incidents in St. Albans and just all across Vermont. That's my question, I guess.
So I thought you were going to ask about is there racial profiling in the state? And the answer to that is lots of people think there is, and there's evidence that there is, but we're still working on getting better data to pinpoint where the problems are. Then the second part of your question, I think, was about the distribution of KKK literature to minority groups, members. And that's an interesting question because our right to distribute information with a particular point of view is usually a highly protected activity. Usually it is protected only unless you are specifically threatening specific people and there is some intent on your part that can be proven that you want to do harm to those people. So I think the case that you might be thinking of in Burlington that was just recently, I think the individual took a plea bargain but reserved the right to appeal the conviction that he agreed to. It's going to be an interesting case because On the one hand, there is the hate crime element to it. On the other hand, there is the right of individuals to distribute literature to people and for people to receive that information if they so choose. So there's a tension there that we all want to be mindful of. We want to protect the rights of people of any race to be left alone and to be able to go about their business and their pursuits without being bothered by other people or harassed. On the other hand, we want to make sure that the right of people to express their viewpoints, even viewpoints we're not comfortable with, is upheld. So it's a challenge when you have two competing rights like that and you have to bring them into balance.
You, as we mentioned at the top of the program, after being the head of the ACLU in Vermont for the last 12 years, you're going to be stepping down from that post. I'm just wondering, as you look back at your career, are there a couple of key issues that really stand out for you?
Yeah, I've been trying to think about this just out of my own curiosity. How were things different when I started in 2004? One of the things that really stands out is how surveillance and privacy and the police role in our lives, government's role in our lives, has really grown. And I think it was largely because of 9/11, the terror attacks, and all the measures that were taken after that to try to get more information about people and prevent things from having happened. We did a report in 2013 called Surveillance on the Northern Border that looked at about five specific areas where much more information is being gathered about us now than there was even 10 years ago. And you put it all together and it painted a different world that we're living in now than we were in 2004 when I started this job. That's been an ongoing theme, and I think it's going to continue to be over the foreseeable future.
Alan Gilbert, director of the ACLU in Vermont, many thanks for being on the program today.
I'm happy to have done this, not now, but other times in the past. Thanks for having me.
And best of luck in your retirement.
Thank you very much.
Lawmakers are hoping to adjourn sometime tomorrow. Will they make it? And what will happen to a number of key bills? Coming up next, I'll talk to Neil Goswami of the Vermont Press Bureau about the latest developments at the State House. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Legislative leaders are hoping to adjourn the 2016 session sometime tomorrow. Are they going to be able to meet this goal? Well, now to give us an update of what's happening at the State House is Neil Goswami, Bureau Chief at the Vermont Press Bureau. Neil, great to have you here.
Hey, good to be back.
So what's the outlook for weekend adjournment? Are they going to make it?
Looks pretty good. It's things are on track for them to adjourn tomorrow after some farewell speeches by leaders.
So one of the big bills coming down the stretch was this energy siting bill.
Mm-hmm.
What was the holdup on that one?
There were a couple of issues that they were really trying to hammer out here. How much, say, municipalities could have in the siting of renewable energy projects, and also the whether or not there would be noise standards for wind projects. I am told as of about 10 minutes ago, they have reached a deal between the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, and they're prepared to move forward on something. However, being here in the studio, I'm not sure what that deal is.
So the governor was talking about vetoing this bill at one point.
Yeah, there was, you know, what they were talking about was essentially whether there would be standards, sound standards, and then what those standards might be. And one of the big sticking points was when they would kick in. There was a proposal that would be retroactive to last month, and there was some pushback on that. So they were trying to work out, you know, the process for making rules surrounding the noise limits and when they would take effect.
Neil, let's look at the issue of marijuana. It's been
yeah.
a fascinating issue all session long. The Senate passed a bill legalizing marijuana mm-hmm. in January of 2018. It created a regulatory structure to sell, grow, and tax marijuana. That bill got 28 votes out of 150 in the House. It was
right.
really a resounding defeat. The House also defeated a bill to decriminalize the growing of two plants. And in the end, the House created a special commission to study this issue. Now, while all this is going on, there was some support to hold a non-binding referendum on the legalization of marijuana in November. Where do things stand now? Has that got any life to it?
No, that too is dead. Actually, everything is dead, and we'll run you through what happened here. Last night, the Senate, Senator Dick Sears, chairman of Senate Judiciary Committee, tried to suspend the Senate rules to take up the bill that contained the Marijuana Commission that would study the issue and report back to lawmakers. And the Senate voted that down, which meant that it would now have to follow the normal Senate process, legislative process, and they would run out of days before adjournment to attach this non-binding, and they call it an advisory question, not a referendum. And so that's not going to happen. It failed they failed to suspend the rules, and the Senate will also not approve the commission to study marijuana. So in effect, there will be, after all of the circus that went on this week and before in the State House, there will be no real step forward on the legalization of marijuana. Now, I will say they did make some changes to the medical marijuana program, adding glaucoma and I think chronic pain to the conditions that can be, you know, that you can have and receive medical marijuana. So they did make some gains there, but for advocates, this has to be a very big disappointment that recreational use of marijuana was not advanced this year.
So why did the Senate decide to reject the commission? Did they feel like, hey, we've studied this enough?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of it might have been spite. that never
really
happens in the building, you know. So, you know, partially spite, and partially they believed that there was really no purpose to this. You know, there's going to be an election coming up in November. You know, members will hear an earful from their constituents, presumably both for and against, and they'll have an understanding of where things need to go. The Senate did some considerable work in the fall, over the summer, and through the spring on the bill. There's the Rand Corporation report is out there, which has plenty of information. And, you know, the House can also do some of the work that the Senate did this year if they feel they want to move forward on it next year. So I think that in the end, they decided the commission wasn't really necessary.
Did you get a sense that some House members feel that it's just too early to evaluate the experience of Colorado and mm-hmm. Washington, two states that have legalized marijuana?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the issues that House Speaker Shep Smith has cited among the House members. They feel that there has not been enough time to digest the data that's available out there from states that have already legalized. And you know, a lot of members are saying it's not that they won't ever support this. They just think they need more time to digest what's happening. So I would think next year or the year after, there will be similar pushes to move this issue forward.
You know, as we're speaking, the Senate was taking up the budget bill. That's one of two or three must-pass pieces of legislation. We also got news yesterday that the revenue report for April is probably mm-hmm. $15 million short.
Yeah.
How does that factor into the budget discussion, or do lawmakers just sort of punt on this until the end of the fiscal year?
So the money bills have been wrapped up by conference committees at this point, and it will not factor in the revenue report from this past month. Now, the fiscal year ends in a couple of months. So in July, we're going to get another revenue, you know, forecast. And so when lawmakers return in January, the new biennium, they might be dealing with a revenue downgrade. They will be certainly dealing with the annual mid-year budget adjustment, and they'll have to make some changes then. But for now, they're moving forward with the projections that they have for the rest of this fiscal year and through the rest of the calendar year.
So another must-pass bill is a fee bill and a mm-hmm. tax bill. And there seemed to be a pretty strong consensus over at the State House this year. Don't raise taxes. Raise
right.
fees on
right.
anybody you want, but don't raise taxes. Is that the end point?
That is the end point. It's reflective. That attitude is reflected in the work that they did and in the agreements that they came to. The fee bill is about $27 million in new revenue. The biggest chunk of that, $24 million, is in this mutual fund fee that financial groups pay to register their fee and sell it to consumers. That raises $24 million, about $24 million of the $27 million The fee bill also contains some new regulations for the EB-5 program, which has been in the news in a very negative way lately. It now requires that developers pay enough money in fees to run the program so that they're essentially the developers are paying for it. And then there's some money in there for the Department of Public Safety as well. On the budget side, or on the tax side, the Senate really didn't like the employer assessment, the fee that employers pay for employees that they do not offer health care to. That was removed. A bank franchise tax was removed. In the end, I think it's only about $3 million or so raised in the tax bill. So they really did try to shift the focus to fees this year.
You know, in his State of the State address, the governor talked about a plan to add an assessment to independent doctors
right.
and all dentists. That seemed to go nowhere.
No, and if you remember last year, he pushed a plan as well to raise money to help fund the state's Medicaid program. And there just seems to be no appetite in this legislative year or this biennium, really, to raise money to help support the Medicaid program. So that's going to be an ongoing problem that a new biennium and a new group of lawmakers will have to deal with. Someone at some point will have to propose a viable plan to have a sustainable Medicaid program.
Earlier in the program, Neil, we were talking about the Ethics Commission and what happened to that bill,
mm-hmm.
the Senate scaling it way, way back and then sending it over to the House really near the end of the session.
Yeah.
What happened to this bill this year, do you think?
You know, I think it was just a bill that really nobody wanted to deal with. I understand there are concerns among lawmakers about how much they should be revealing about themselves or their own personal financial situations or how much authority they should cede to others in terms of, you know, policing themselves. But in the end, they sort of dilly-dallied around until it was too late. They passed a very scaled-back bill in the Senate, and the House said they didn't have time to deal with it. You know, this is something that the ACLU of Vermont and others are not going to give up on. And it's going to come back again next year, I would imagine. And it'll be increasingly harder for lawmakers to keep putting this off. Unfortunately, we do have situations like the EB-5 program where people tend to question government a bit. And that's not – well, we hope it will stop, but that's likely, you know, things like that will happen again in the future. So, yeah, it'll be back, and at some point they won't be able to put it off forever.
You know, there was an interesting bill dealing with independent contractors that really just tied the House up in knots this year. The bill actually really never made it for a full
right.
vote on the House floor. Why did this bill become so controversial?
You know, it's really a dispute between business and labor. And, you know, I think you've talked about this bill on a number of occasions on this program. So listeners are probably aware that it's about how you classify an employee, whether they're an employee of the company or an independent contractor that is, you know, paid by the company. And really the disagreement in the end came down to a very big worry among some that employers under the language that they were considering would be able to essentially get rid of their employees and replace them with independent contractors. And in doing so, they wouldn't have to pay insurance and benefits and things like that. If you ask labor, it's business's fault. If you ask business, it's labor's fault. I think they were closer than they've ever been this year to something, and there will be a lot of momentum and push early next year to get something across the finish line.
You know, one of the big questions at the State House as it winds down is what will House Speaker Shap Smith do in 2016? On this program last week, he said he's seriously looking at running for the Democratic nomination for lieutenant governor.
Right.
What do you think? Will he do it?
You know, I will say a week or two ago on this very program, I said I thought they would get a pot bill through. So we should let people know that my predictions are not very good. But I do think it seems that he is very much considering it. And it seems to me that he's on his way to announcing something along those lines very soon.
And if he does run, how does it alter the race in any way?
I don't think people will drop out. You know, there's Senator David Zuckerman was very pro-pot this year. He wants to see recreational use of marijuana legalized. We noticed that Keisha Rahm, Representative Rahm of Burlington, voted against the Senate proposal in the House, and a progressive, an ally of Zuckerman, Chris Pearson, sent out a tweet noting her vote. So, you know, this is going to be something that comes up, and I expect it, if he joins, it'll be a three-way race, and they hash it out.
A lot of issues in play in the final days of the session. Neil Goswami, many thanks for your update.
Always a pleasure.
We really appreciate it. That is our show for today. Monday on Vermont Edition, we'll wrap up the entire legislative session with a group of State House reporters who've been watching the session up close. Send your questions and comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us for a reporters' roundtable on Monday. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari and Sam Gail Rosen with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.